Hey everyone, thanks for coming out to the Ogilvy Day Stage. We're thrilled to have our next presenter, Dov Seidman, author of Why We Do Anything Means Everything. Fortune magazine called Dov the hottest advisor on the corporate virtue circuit, and he was also named one of the top 60 global thinkers of the last decade by the Economic Times. He's a Harvard Law School graduate, and he also has a bachelor and master's degree in moral philosophy from UCLA and a BA in philosophy, politics, and economics from Oxford. He was actually raising about $30 million in the late 90s for cloud before it was even called that. And he's the founder and CEO of LRN, which is a global company with 300 employees that built a platform that's educated and engaged 20 million people in 100 countries in 50 languages. His book features a foreword by President Bill Clinton, and we're excited to welcome Dov.
Thank you, Libby, and I so much appreciate each and every one of you choosing to come. And I was looking ahead in the program, and I know that we're turning into the music phase of this great time here in Austin, and I noticed that Lionel Richie is going to be performing tomorrow night, and it reminded me that I ought to share with you my first job. The first job I ever had was washing Lionel Richie's cars every Saturday for 3 years. And I put away enough money to put myself through college, but I also fell in love with entrepreneurialism. And the second job I ever had, which is as the founder of LRN, is the only job I've stuck with, which brings me here today. So I share with you the spirit of entrepreneurialism, its disruption, the idea that we can look at the world the way it is and ask, how do we make it better and different, and how do we attach human endeavor to human progress. And that's the spirit that animates me. And I thought I would just say to you that from a background standpoint, I'm a moral philosopher who wears a suit for a living. I operate in the rough and tumble world. I'm glad that I could take my tie off and just connect in a more casual way here. But one idea has animated my entire career, that principles and profits can come together and be in a reinforcing relationship. You can do good and well at the same time. And frankly, the world has changed in ways that that's the only idea that can animate us if we want to be here and do something built to last. So what I'd like to do is come here to Austin and literally share with you just one idea. And if this idea resonates with you, then I'm going to ask you on the merits to just take one action. Fair enough? Okay. And to illustrate the idea, I'm going to start with a story by one of the sponsors of this great conference, Southwest Airlines. How many of you flew here on Southwest Airlines? And how many of you have flown that airline? Okay. So the other day, we were landing in Las Vegas on a Southwest Airlines flight. And as the plane came to the gate, the flight attendant came on the speaker with passion and enthusiasm and said, "Listen, fellow passengers, we've done research in Southwest Airlines, and we have proven that if before you deplane, you would simply turn around and cross your seatbelts one over the other, you will have good luck at the tables when you gamble later tonight." True, and we all laughed just the way you did. But then we did it. Now, there's a federal regulation that says that seatbelts must be crossed before the next plane can take off. They also turn their planes around 6 minutes faster than their nearest rival. How long do you think it would have taken her to go up and down the aisles and cross the seatbelts herself? You figure it, 6 minutes. Through how she reached out and connected with us, she got us to help her airline comply with a federal regulation and gain an operational advantage because they turn their planes 6 minutes faster than their nearest rival. They also make a promise to the world: home on time, no frills, safe, and fun. She acted in a way that was consonant with that, that made my connection to the airline authentic. And she did it with so much passion that I'm here telling you about it. She made a wave on behalf of her airline. Raise your hand if you think the world would be a better place if more people brought their character and creativity to the job the way she did. And raise your hand if we would have a better world if more leaders created an environment of so much freedom and trust that she felt inspired to lean in further. Because I submit to you, there is no manual in Southwest Airlines that instructs her to tell the gambling joke when she lands in Las Vegas. She doesn't get paid extra for doing that. She's inspired. So raise your hand if we had more of those leaders, we'd be in a better place. So I've got some bad news. You want to bring around that world, and we have work to do. 7 out of 10 employees are not engaged on the job today. 2 out of those 7 are actively disengaged, meaning they are actively subverting or sabotaging their company. You got it on social networks saying something less than charitable or kind. We have a jobs crisis out there, but we also have a careers crisis where 7 out of 10 people on the job are not flying to work, innovating so much that they are creating other jobs for their brothers and sisters, uncles and cousins, and friends. What's going on here? Well, I spent some time in Los Angeles before my wife Maria and I, who's here with me today, moved recently to New York. So I tend to look at society through the lens of movies. How many of you have quoted from The Godfather? Come on. How many of you have quoted the line from the famous scene where Tessio is about to be carted off for his execution for the attempted murder of Michael Corleone? He has the temerity to stop and say, "Hey, please tell Michael it's not personal. I always liked him. It's strictly business." Let me tell you something. If we can accomplish this feat to create a separate sphere where it's just business, then greed is good. Let's become too big to fail. These are rational strategies. It's rational. If we can create a separate locker room at Penn State where what happens in a sports locker room is different than what happens in a real locker room, it's just sports, or in D.C., just politics. If we can go to funerals and hear that he was a jerk at work but a loving husband and a ruthless negotiator but a caring father, if we can keep creating these separations, then the strategies that have animated human endeavor to date are rational and good, and I urge you to keep pursuing them. But if from Tahrir Square to Occupy Wall Street, if you think that we are now living in a world where everything is indeed personal because everything is indeed social, and you are making everything become social faster than we're developing human frameworks to get along and understand each other because I eat steak, and social networks have put me in contact with people for whom a cow is a sacred being, and we haven't broken bread yet, we haven't figured out how to get along, but I have been socialed because my email has been removed, I've been given an @ or a hashtag, and I've been told, collaborate and connect. So if you think we're in a social world, then I want to open your minds to a new strategy. And the strategy is one that maps to the fact that the world is not just connected, it's not just interconnected. David Hume, the moral philosopher, said that the moral imagination diminishes with distance. We now live in a world where there's no distance, so the moral imagination has to be reawakened and comes back in. We are in an interdependent world where we are rising and falling together. We could wake up any morning and one vegetable vendor in Tunisia with a few friends with cell phone cameras can spark a revolution towards freedom throughout the entire Middle East. And at the same time, one banker at his desk in London can lose $2 billion trading for his firm, introduce more risk into the markets, cost bonuses, and hurt our pension funds. We are in a world where we rise and fall together. And in this world, power is shifting. Netflix thought it was pretty powerful. Every day, look at how many subscribers we had. And one day they decided, we're so powerful, we can raise prices just a bit. And 800,000 of their subscribers bolted overnight. Bank of America tried a $5 increase for a debit card. People went online and said, not so fast. We now live in a world where we have democratized to the individual the power to be a source for good or harm. And it's up to us to build frameworks and to manifest the kind of leadership where people are inspired, like the Southwest Airlines pilot, even though she doesn't have to. She's inspired to do the right thing and connect in the right way. So, I want to make a declaration. I believe that we are in the era of behavior. Now, behavior has always mattered. I just have come to believe that it matters more than ever and in ways it never has before. How we relate, how we connect, how we say we're sorry, how we engender trust, all of our behaviors are now the source of competitive advantage. They allow us to play defense, stay out of jail, but more importantly, they allow us to affirmatively connect and collaborate to create value. Now, this is a book reading, so indulge me with just a few lines because I want to check that box in honor of this conference that asked me to do that. I want to read the first line from the book. The first line says, this is a how book, not a how-to book. What's the difference between how-to and how? Everything. And then I'm going to read the very last line in the acknowledgments. And to all those of you who questioned how I was going to make a living with philosophy, this is how. Now, I could read something in between the first and last line, but I think you get the idea. To understand how is to understand you can't reduce it to seven things that how people do or three things that you ought to walk off here and do. I'm trying to share an idea with you that if you embrace, you look at endeavor, life, business through a new lens, and you'll innovate for yourself how to do how. And the first idea is that if we are in the era of behavior, when the financial crisis hit, all sorts of powerful people said we need a reboot, a reset, or a reform. What do they have in common? Let's keep the system just the way it is and reform it a little bit. Tinker at its margins. Einstein warned us that when you're in a new era, shed the thinking from the last era and have the courage not to reset, reboot, or reform the system, but to rethink fundamentals. How do we lead people? What is a company's relationship to society? Should we scale just our products, or should we scale our values? When I'm with venture capitalists, I always ask them, when was the last time, when was one of you asked by a venture capitalist, not just how are you going to scale your business? Have you ever been asked, how are you going to scale your values? How are you going to hire for character, not just for talent? Have you ever been asked those questions? Will you indulge me and raise your hand if you think there's merit to asking those questions? Wow, we got work to do, right? We're not getting asked questions we need to ask, and you think the questions matter because their answers matter. So, I am going to do three things, and I'm going to ask you to connect with me around rethinking three things. The first thing we are going to rethink is the idea of how itself. Let's be honest, we've cheapened the word. How's it going, buddy? How are we going to get from here to there? And then we count with the word, how much revenue, how much market share. If a friend came to you in crisis, sir, let me ask you, if a friend came to you in crisis and said, what's your name? Right. I need $10,000. Would you say, how about eight? Or would you say, how are you living your life? How as your friend can I help you get back on track? Would you have a how much conversation? Is it 10 you need or eight? Or would you have a how conversation? Who says how much? Who says how? Right? Life's about how we connect, how we collaborate, right? But why is it that even though life is about how, when we scale, we go from how to how much? How much GDP? How much stimulus? How much debt ceiling? How much market share? How much revenue? How much profit can we squeeze into this quarter? And then we go into the new economy, and what do? How many friends? How many followers? How many page views? Well, Netflix was counting how many subscribers. Did they build loyalty? We don't know. So the one idea that I came to Austin with is this idea. How is not just a question. How is the answer? It's not an adverb. How are you? How much? It's a noun. It's the how that makes the difference. Let's get our hows right. And if we see how as a strategy, as a platform for innovation, then we will do how. And not just count up to how. So the first thing I want you to rethink is behavior itself. When do we tell a child to behave? Right after the child misbehaves. We talk about good behavior. He was let out of prison early for good behavior. We see behavior like goalkeeping, not giving up any goals in business and in life. And if you go into the dictionary and you type in the word outperform, outproduce, even outdrink. I know we've been doing some of that here. I had two margaritas last night. Outdrink is in the dictionary. Outfox, outsmart, outmaneuver. These are all words because they've qualified for inclusion in the dictionary because they are part of common vernacular because they commonly describe how we think and how we behave. What if I told you that the word outbehave is not yet until we together make it so in the dictionary? The very idea that behavior is the source of advantage, that it's the source of excellence, that we can use behavior to get ahead, is not in the dictionary along with outsmart and outfox. So we have to rethink the strategic value of behavior itself. just like the person at Southwest Airlines is using her behavior, how she relates and connects to get advantage for her company. And as you build great companies, think of how through behavior you could stand out. Let's face it, technology is commoditizing things faster than ever. We could win with technology. Today, it just keeps us in the game, right? Every product invented, you're here going around, who's doing what I'm doing? Who's got something like what I'm doing? And here's why we're going to be better than them, right? Faster than ever. Business is always about creating something the competition can't copy. And I'm telling you right now, there are other airlines that cannot copy what Southwest Airlines does. How we do what we get to manifest so uniquely, so richly, so individually, that it's the one thing the competition can't copy, so why not invest in scaling that? Because you will have lasting advantage. The second thing we should rethink is measurement. Have you heard the old adage, what you measure is what you get, that we manage what we measure, right? Well, what we measure is a choice. It's a window into what we value and even into our values. As I said before, this is what we tend to measure. But what if you could measure the how so that we could do the how? What if we can measure how we engender trust? Are these connections meaningful? Have we engendered loyalty? Are people inspired? You think we would be better at running our businesses? So, we've done that. We recently did a study, an independent study of over 5,000 people in small, medium, and large companies all over the world. And we saw companies in four archetypes. One of them was anarchy. I'm not going to regale you about anarchy. We all know anarchy on our own terms. The other is blind obedience. It's kind of what it sounds like. People are blindly expected to march and obey, very hierarchical. The other is informed acquiescence, more rational, success-based, lots of rules and policies, carrots and sticks, command and control. We've seen those institutions, and many of you have chosen probably not to work at them, right? And the other one is self-governance, where people do the right thing because they are inspired to do the right thing. They are pursuing a mission worthy of their commitment and dedication. And they are shared values that allow people to collaborate because everybody acknowledges that they're pursuing something greater than any individual. And I've got some good news and bad news for you. If you can succeed in creating a values-based corporate culture, you will have much less misconduct, the behaviors you don't want. You will have much more innovation, employee loyalty, satisfied customers, 5 times the receptivity and adoption of new ideas, a better reputation, people would recommend your company to a friend, and much better financial performance. That's the good news. You know what the bad news is? Only 3% of companies are self-governing. That's the reality. But through our leadership, we can move forward. And one of the things the leadership needs to attack is the following disconnect. CEOs are 8 times more likely to observe around them self-governance than the people charged with getting the work done. So we need a new age of leaders that can take us on this journey. And that's the last thing I want you to rethink with me, is leadership itself. Close your eyes or not, think for the next 15 seconds about a leader that you admire and the characteristics that she or he manifests and personifies. I'm going to tell you about one that inspires me, and I believe is the greatest inspirational leader of our time. Crazy George Henderson. How many of you have participated in a wave in a stadium? It's a beautiful act, an unbroken wave of human energy. It's usually not catalyzed or inspired by the CEO in the crowd or the rich people in the crowd. It's four guys who've had a few too many beers or some soccer moms and guys together, right? These waves are so powerful that they go round and around and around, and we forget who started them. They're so powerful that even if you came to root for the opposition, you stand up in the wave. The more independent the world gets, the more interconnected, the possibility, like Netflix is figuring out, of having power over people is giving way to power through people. The most affordable, clean, renewable, cheap energy is human energy. That's why Chevron is now saying they're the human energy company, and Cisco is saying that they're the human network, and Dow is saying that they're the human element, and Ally Bank is saying we speak human. One company after another is acknowledging we're in the era of behavior where let's have a relationship, not because of our product and service, but who we are. And I know what you're thinking, isn't that just marketing? It probably is. But we can translate that marketing into corporate practices, leadership, and individual behaviors that allow you to outbehave the competition towards advantage. Now think about a wave. I spoke to Crazy George. In 1981, he was the first person to get 46,000 people in Oakland Alameda Stadium to get up and go round and around. I said, how did you do it? Did you walk up to somebody and say, I'll punch you if you don't get up, I'm stronger than you? It would have worked with this guy, but people over there were safe outside his reach. Did you motivate the wave? Here's $5, here's $5, here's $5. Absolutely not. You didn't motivate the wave. Were you secretive and non-transparent? Get up and I won't tell you why. He got every one of his hows right. He was passionate. He was transparent. He shared a mission with them that if we do this, we will give our home team a home field advantage. Every email, every tweet, every conversation, every negotiation is a wave that either crashes on shores or creates human energy. I think it's the metaphor of the 21st century. From Occupy Wall Street to Tahrir to Rome to the fact that employees are now getting jobs at companies and they're not calling mom and dad and saying, I'm official, I have an email. They're saying, I have a hashtag or an at sign before my name and I am just social. That means that we are in wave-making territory. And when you're in wave-making territory and you're asking for human things out of people, not just productivity and hard work, but efficiency and resiliency and creativity and character, we need to understand that we have three choices. We can no longer coerce the behaviors we want. Maybe they worked when we wanted quasi-robotic behaviors of people to repeat themselves on factory assembly lines. But you can't say, thou shalt have an idea in the next 2 hours, and you two people must collaborate. You cannot command. You can't even incentivize and motivate the humanistic behaviors we want from people. They can only be inspired. And one clue for you, the first two letters in the word inspiration are in. What's in us? Beliefs, passions, missions, purpose. If we can connect with people meaningfully inside, they will be inspired. Carrots and sticks are external. They're commodities. Your competition has as many carrots as you do. But the inspiration is renewable, and it makes waves. So finally, I want to suggest one more thing that inspirational leaders do, and then I'd like to have a bit of a conversation. We've just met. Do you think that if the world had more trust in it, like Southwest Airlines, more people would speak up in meetings, volunteer their best ideas, and come together? More trust is a better thing? Only 9% of companies are high trust. We've just met. I'm going to ask you a 50-50 question. According to Aristotle, who has the virtue of trust? Me for trusting you or you for being trustworthy? Raise your hand if you think the virtue of trust lies in you for being trustworthy. You have to play 50-50. And raise your hand if you think it's me for trusting you. Isn't that interesting? We all want more trust. Half of you are going to walk out those doors and say, let's go looking for it. Who can we trust? This vendor, this supplier, should we hire this person? Half of you are going to give it away. We've grown up in a system where we trust and verify, checks and balances. We look for trust because we think trust is outside of us. The virtue of trust lies in giving it away because when I give it away, I'm the one taking the risk. I stand here and I'm giving you the power to do right by me or let me down. And if we want innovation, it only happens when people take the risk to innovate, and people only take the risk when someone is extending trust to them. There's been research done that trust is a drug. When someone feels that trust has been extended to them, oxytocin is released in their brain. Whatever makes them leery and weary of you subsides, and they reciprocate that trust in a virtuous cycle of connection. I write about a donut guy that the only innovation was to put a tray of loose change, and he said to his customers, I trust you to innovate. And he outsold the guy Kitty Corner, who had an equally fresh, equally priced donut, 3-1. The rock band Radiohead trusted their fans to pay what they thought the music was worth, and they made more money in the fifth album than in the 5 cumulative heretofore. In Indonesia, there are now 10,000 honesty cafes where they're fighting corruption in Indonesia by teaching citizens to walk up and take food off the shelves and instead of go to a cashier to put money in a jar and make their own change. Give trust away. That will inspire. So I want to end where I began, to urge you to think that how is not just a question, it's an answer. It's the answer. It's a strategy. It's a journey. We think that business is linear. Journeys are curvilinear. There are football coaches who no longer scream at their players. There are CEOs who figured out that they need to connect and collaborate. Others are saying they're sorry more. It's a journey. Journeys are curvilinear. They're up and down. So go to your next meeting and don't say what's on the agenda, but how are we going to connect and collaborate? Reward one of your colleagues, not for just how much they got done, but how they did it. And give trust away. And thank you. I would love some questions or comments. Please. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So the question is, hey, we get burned from time to time or a lot. How do you give trust away when you get burned? I'm not saying let's have lobotomies that become non-rational. We tend to trust people who say what they mean what they say, and follow through. There are other values such as integrity and truth. But when you feel like you're dealing with people that have integrity, give them trust, you'll get a lot back. The other thing to keep in mind, and we've studied this, you could go to two companies and here we pay for expenses. And we only pay for expenses when you get two signatures. Here we pay for expenses, we just pay. But if you betray the system here, you've committed a bigger crime, betraying trust. We have already demonstrated that there's better behavior in a system without the two controls than with it. Because people self-regulate. The donut guy that I talked about, if someone took too much change, the people in line would have said, not here, buddy, don't spoil the party. You get more colleagues and peers helping out if they're inspired. In this system, hey, it's the factory foreman's job, it's the boss's job. Behavior is not my responsibility. And you've got to create the culture to do that, and it takes time. But you have to celebrate those who live the values and discipline those who don't, and people figure out that we want to be more like the Southwest Airlines cabin than one where pilots won't take baby strollers downstairs and people who fly the planes only fly the planes and no one's trying to do extra because they're not interested in connecting with you. Others? Please, back there. Yeah. Yeah. So it turns out that you need, great question, do you need the next guy? They've studied this. It takes 12 to 20 people to make a wave. They don't happen in high school football stadiums where one side is rooting against the opposition. They happen in transparent oval stadiums where everyone's connected. And they happen when those 12 to 20 people have so much passion that they get up in a way where others have to follow them. It always takes one to bang the drum for something he believes in. But if the people in his section just keep sitting there, the wave's not going to go. So leaders today need to create an orchestra, a symphony, and they really need to spread that through a few people and not be single or singular in that way. Others? One more here, please. Yeah. So questions on how you measure. Right now, the measures of the intangibles tend to be very emotional, like employee engagement surveys. Has your boss taken you to lunch recently? Well, I don't want my boss taking me to lunch if he berates me at lunch. Do you have a friend at work? Are you happy here? We tend to ask pulse. We need to go beyond that, which is an X-ray, and create an MRI, which we've developed, that looks at behavior. If you go around your boss because it's the right thing to do, do you get punished or celebrated? Do you have permission to do A, B, and C? And we start measuring behaviors that happen or don't happen or the consequences of those behaviors. And there are metrics that we're starting to develop that we are measuring behaviors that count. If these behaviors are true, they're going to engender trust. If the opposite is true, they're going to not. But that's the idea here. And one way to frame this for you, everything that was once hard in business, a product or a service, has now become the commodity. Everything that was soft but important, trust, reputation, leadership, all the soft is now becoming the hard currency, the new source of differentiation. It's a new era. We're years away. We did it with quality. The Japanese were mopping the floor with U.S. business because we had a philosophical disagreement. They took quality and made it part of everything. we were at the end of the assembly line inspecting for bad quality. We got sick of losing to them when they bought Pebble Beach and Rockefeller Center, and we didn't know what we were doing, but we declared quality as job one. And then we went on a 10-year journey, and now every employee was trying to get a green belt or a black belt in TQM or Six Sigma, etc. We are now declaring behavior humanity job one. That's the new era. Those that can get disciplined and intentional and measurable about it, I think, are going to be here in 10 years and thriving. We're at the beginning of something. It's a journey, and it's a journey of leadership. Please. Yeah. Yeah. Well, two things. Marketing, I have two comments. One is marketing is undergoing a renaissance. McDonald's used to say, we must be a great company. Billions of people served here. Now they're part of a conversation about trans fats and childhood obesity. The ability to proclaim and communicate and just advertise used to be very powerful. And that's all we used to do. And we'd get 1% to 2% response rates, and we're here to go. Now you need to live the values through behavior. So marketing is giving way to behavior, because if you say you're one thing in a connected, transparent world and you're not, you're crossed the Rubicon by saying it, but you got quite a gap. So what's starting to happen is marketing is collaborating with line managers to say, how do we inspire and foster a culture where people are behaving the proclamation, the marketing? So the future of marketing are for people who understand that the expression and the communication has its limits, it's important, and the marketing folks that are really starting to get into leadership and behavior and how to create environments where the brand is lived and not just asserted, where reputation isn't just managed but is earned through authentic impressions and real social connections, those are the marketing people that are going to add the most value. So I would encourage you to think that way. Listen, if we can get, if we can bring down Mubarak in 17 days, I had a CEO of one of the largest consumer companies over lunch say to me the following, hey, Dove, it took them 17 days to get rid of Mubarak. The guy had a military. What if my own employees and consumers didn't like how I was leading the company? The power for junior people today, junior in quotes because they're early in their career, to come together and say, we have an idea. There's a better way to do something. We're on the front lines of the business. We're on Facebook. We're talking on behalf of the company. We're getting expressions of experience, we like to bring them to you, is enormous. And if you want to make your career, lean in and take the risk. And if people don't want to listen to you, try one more time, try again, make a wave, gang up. And if not, it's the wrong place for you. Please. Yes. So the question is, what about the why? I tend to like words. Who and how are an anagram, same letters, different order. And Heraclitus said that character is your destiny. It always takes who to do how. I end the book with the ultimate how. And I talk about the paradox of hedonism, that if you pursue happiness, it will elude you. But if you do something of significance that's meaningful, happiness can find you. I created a corollary that I call the paradox of success. If you don't have a why, and you pursue success directly, as we've just seen, it will elude you. But if you pursue significance, truly being other-regarding, because you have a purpose, a why, then I call the ultimate how significance, because I'm incorporating the idea of why through the language of significance as opposed to success. So the idea is if you pursue significance, you create the space for success to find you in that way. So another way to be cute about it is who, why, and how are three-letter words, and what is the four-letter word in this? It stands out. It's the commodity. You need it, but it keeps you in the game. If you can create a reinforcing system of why, who, and how, I think you're good to go. Others? Please, sir. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Are there any examples Sure. I actually write about the largest Ponzi scheme ever in the first edition of this book before Madoff. I write about a golfer, David Toms, who disqualified himself. He risked his whole career in the British Open competing for the championship. Big stakes. Because I argued that personal and professional can't keep separate, and Tiger Woods obviously didn't read the book. So I think you could do this at all stakes. The point is, we're at the beginning of a new era, and I'd like to combine the two questions. The financial services industry, by and large, the product is money, the scorekeeping is money, etc. It's hard to have a separate relationship between I'm going to do this and create value, and I'm going to make money. We're doing this to make money. And when you don't have that relationship between why and how, you get people extracting money from the society as opposed to enlarging the pizza in that way. I think we're new at this. I don't think in 10 years you're going to see people making these kinds of ridiculous bets and we're all sitting around watching it happen in that way. I don't think that 40% of corporate profits in the United States are going to be in Wall Street. People like you are going to invent other ways to create value that are not just with money. We need a vibrant financial community, but it doesn't need to be 40% of our economy. Just my view. I think it's probably a good time to just... I'm going to be outside signing books. I'd be happy to have some more one-on-one conversations, but sincerely, thank you for taking the time to be here today. I really appreciate it.